sigh. It took her till the middle of Huntley and Brinkley to remember that last year at 3 or so, one morning, there had come this long-distance call, from where she would never know, unless now he'd left a diary, by a voice beginning in heavy Slavic tones as second secretary at the Transylvanian consulate, looking for an escaped bat, modulated to comic Negro, then on into hostile Pachuco dialect, full of chingas and maracones, then a Gestapo officer asking her in shrieks did she have relatives in Germany, and finally his Lamont Cranston voice, the one he'd talked in all the way down to Mazatlan. "Pierce, please," she'd managed to get in. "I thought we had..."
"But Margot," earnestly, "I've just come from Commissioner Weston, and that old man in the funhouse was murdered by the same blowgun that killed Professor Quackenbush, or something."
"For God's sake," she said. Mucho had rolled over and was looking at her.
"Why don't you hang up on him?" Mucho suggested sensibly. "I heard that," Pierce said. "I think it's time Wendell Moss had a little visit from the Shadow."
Silence, positive and thorough, fell. So it was the last of his voices she ever heard. Lamont Cranston. That phone line could have pointed any direction, been any length. Its quiet ambiguity shifted over in the months after the call to what had been revived. Memories of his face, body, things he'd given her, things she had now and then pretended not to have heard him say. It took him over and to the verge of being forgotten. The Shadow waited a year before visiting. But now there was Metzger's letter. Had Pierce called last year then to tell her about this codicil? Or had he decided on it later, somehow because of her annoyance and Mucho's indifference? She felt exposed, finessed, put down. She had never executed a will in her life, didn't know where to begin, didn't know how to tell the law firm in L.A. that she didn't know where to begin. "Mucho, baby," she cried in an access of helplessness. Mucho Moss, home, bounded through the screen door. "Today was another defeat," he began. "Let me tell you," she also began, but let Mucho go first. He was a disc jockey who worked further along the peninsula and suffered regular crises of conscience about his profession. "I don't believe in any of it, Ed," he could usually get out. "I try. I truly can't." Way down there, further down perhaps than she could reach, so that such times often brought her near panic. It might have been the sight of her so about to lose control that seemed to bring him back up. "You're too sensitive." Yeah, there was so much else she ought to be saying also, but this was what came out. It was true, anyway. For a couple years, he'd been a used car salesman, and so hyper-aware of what that profession had come to mean that working hours were exquisite torture to him. Mucho shaved his upper lip every morning 3 times, with 3 times against the grain, to remove any remotest breath of a mustache. New blades he drew blood invariably, but kept at it. Bought all-natural shoulder suits, then went to a tailor to have the lapels made yet more abnormally narrow. On his hair, used only water, combing it like Jack Lemmon to throw them further off. The sight of sawdust, even pencil shavings, made him wince. His own kind being known to use it for hushing sick transmissions, and though he dieted, he could still not, as Oedipa did, use honey to sweeten his coffee, for like all things viscous, it distressed him, recalling too poignantly what is often mixed with motor oil to ooze dishonest into gaps between piston and cylinder wall. He walked out of a party